Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's podcast episode is brought to you by NetSuite. Where do we begin? Another Wednesday in Trump world, the president rather predictably backing off of any sort of serious gun control legislation. You knew that was going to happen. Apparently, the tax cuts are back on. Well, maybe not. Who knows? After denying for about 24 hours that they were considering cutting the payroll tax, the president says, yeah, we're considering it. But of course, we're supposed to also believe that there's nothing wrong with the economy. So there's that. The president. And this is one of those days where, you know, any one of these stories would be huge in and of themselves. The president suggests bringing Russia back into the G7 after, of course, it was expelled for invading Ukraine and Crimea. Just throws that out there. He cancels his trip to Denmark over their refusal to sell Greenland. This is beyond any sort of parody or farce. In my newsletter today, I really think that the movie that Americans need to watch now is go out and if you've never seen the movie The Mouse That Roared, Peter Sellers, it was his first movie. It was out 60 years ago, and it's about a war with the Grand Duchy of Fenwick, since we're getting in the mood for the Great War with Denmark. And it's a fantastic movie where, you know, Peter Sellers is, you know, prime minister of this little country that runs out of money and figures the only way to you know, solve its financial problems is to declare war on the United States, of course, lose, and then get all the foreign aid. And I don't want to give any more away, but since we are now talking about possibly going to war with, well, we're not actually going to war with Denmark. Although one of the strangest things is that, and I actually, you know, quote this in the newsletter. You know that Ted Cruz actually called this shot back in 2016. He did. You know, memories here. He says, I don't know anyone who would be comfortable with someone who behaves this way, having his finger on the button, Cruz said about Trump. I mean, we're liable to wake up one morning and Donald, if he were president, would have nuked Denmark. it seems random, but, you know, again, we're beyond parody. And then, of course, the president also questioned the loyalty of Jews who voted for Democrats. And yet none of that is really the strangest thing that's happened in the last 24 hours. He's apparently this morning did a tweet of a conspiracy theorist named Wayne Allen Root, who called him the second coming of God. He goes on Twitter to thank this guy, this conspiracy theorist, for likening his rise to power to the second coming of God. And he quoted Root's tweets, referring to him as the greatest president for Jews and for Israel in the history of the world, not just America. And I mean, first of all, you have to understand who this guy is. Wayne Allen Root has, you know, pushed conspiracy theories involving the Las Vegas shooter, said he had ISIS ties. He said that Charlottesville was a false flag, that Seth Rich was murdered by any number of Democrats. He's a notorious birther. In fact, he suggested that Seth Rich might have been murdered by Hillary Clinton, John Podesta, and even former New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman. So, but the guy's out there, and he is tweeting that, I actually have to read this. Thank you to Wayne Allen Root for the very nice words. And then he quotes, you know, how everyone in the world loves him, and they think of him as basically, what, the second coming. You have to look up, you know, they love him like he is the second coming of God. I can't imagine anything sort of less Jewish than that. And meanwhile, of course, these polls continue to be, it is early, but they are increasingly scary for the president. We had a piece yesterday in the Bulwark saying that the president ought to be very, very nervous. The number to look at is not his approval rating, which continues to fall, but is relatively steady, but his rising disapproval rating and his erosion of support among constituencies that he absolutely positively would have if he was going to pull an inside straight like he did in 2016. And that, of course, has led to more speculation about his political future within the GOP. And there's a story in today's Washington Post by Robert Costa and Phil Rucker. Trump critics eye GOP primary race, even if defeating him seems preposterous. And here's the lead. Joe Walsh, a pugnacious former congressman, is preparing a Republican primary challenge to President Trump that he previewed as a daily bar fight with the incumbent over his morality and his competency. Mark Sanford, a former South Carolina governor and congressman, said he is inching closer to a bid of his own by sounding out activists in New Hampshire and other states. Jeff Flake, a former Arizona senator and Trump antagonist, said he has taken a flurry of recruitment calls in recent days from GOP donors rattled by signs of an economic slowdown and hungry for an alternative to Trump. And former Governor John Kasich will head to New Hampshire next month to, quote unquote, take a look at things after experiencing, quote, an increase in overtures this summer, an advisor said. And of course, Bill Weld is already in the race. So with all of this going on, who better to talk to than that pugnacious former congressman, Joe Walsh, who joins me on the podcast. How you doing, Joe? Welcome back.
Charlie, I'd love to listen to the last 3 minutes of what of your last 3 minutes. Oh, my God, the world is burning. Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Well, that's what's so strange about it. And I confess that I'm a little bit obsessed with the whole Greenland thing because it is sort of this moment of absurd. I mean, yesterday was this mixture of outrage and farce. I mean, the outrage being the questioning the loyalty of Jews and the farce, you know, being, look, we're in the midst of this trade war. We're recovering from mass shootings. There are these massive demonstrations in Hong Kong, delicate negotiations with the Taliban. You know, the North Koreans are still firing off missiles. And the president is obsessing about buying Greenland, which is not for sale, and is melting anyway. So where do you want to start with this, Joe?
I start, Charlie, my friend, with sort of a big picture take. So this was just one more morning that you and I and everybody else in this great country woke up, reminded again that Donald Trump is completely unfit to be president. That's not news. What I continue to find most disappointing, Charlie Sykes, is once again this morning, is the continued cowardly silence of congressional Republicans in the face of this overwhelming truth that Donald Trump is completely unfit. Everybody, Charlie, everybody knows it. Every Republican knows it. So few say that publicly.
Okay, you actually had a piece in the New York Times last week saying there's a strong case for President Trump to face a primary challenger, and you know a thing or two about insurgencies. You were elected in the 2010 Tea Party insurgency. Mm-hmm. So is it about his character and his morality? Is it about his character and his record? What would the strongest primary challenge to Donald Trump sound like?
He's unfit. He's nuts. He's a bully. He's cruel. He's dishonest. He lies every time he opens his mouth. He embraces Putin instead of our own men and women in the intelligence community. He's unfit, period. It's the moral case, Charlie. Look, I care about the debt and the deficits. I'm opposed to tariffs. I'd like to see the wall as part of our southern border, but man, this is so far beyond issues. And with all due respect to good men like Mark Sanford and Bill Weld, other people either in the race or thinking about getting in the race, if you think you're going to primary Donald Trump to start a conversation about the debt, I'm sorry. Again, with all due respect, that's no reason to primary Donald Trump. This is an existential threat right now. He is an existential threat to this country. I firmly believe that. And so to get out there and to think you're going to talk about the debt and the deficits, that's crazy. He's unfit. And this is the time for good men to stand up and good women and to say that.
Well, in your Times piece, you also, though, challenged his conservative credentials. You did say that he's reckless on fiscal issues. He's incompetent on the border. He's clueless on trade. He misunderstands executive power and he subverts the rule of law. So all of those things are also the substantive issue-based challenge.
Yes. And to me, Charlie, with Trump, it's always kind of come down to this. He's fundamentally dishonest. He lies every time he opens his mouth. He's been doing it his whole life. I voted for him in 2016, as you know, not because I loved him and not because I liked him, but because he wasn't Hillary Clinton. When I voted for him, Charlie, I just figured he's a goof, but he'll hire some good people and maybe some good policy will get enacted. It became pretty clear to me after he got elected, just following him and paying attention to him every day, again, that he lies every time he opens his mouth. And I can't have a president like that. I don't care what your politics are. If you can't believe a single word your president says, then you can't support that president.
But okay, let's talk about this though, because everything you just said has been known for some time, and the majority of Republicans seem to be okay with it. I just read a quote a little earlier from Ted Cruz, who talked about his manifest instability and how terrible it would be to have Donald Trump's finger on the button. We knew that. They knew that back in 2016. What's changed? What makes you think that Republicans are going to wake up in 2020 and say, yeah, we've decided that we're no longer okay with that?
And Charlie, I plead guilty because I didn't know that. And this may sound crazy. I just figured Trump was a goof and I didn't pay. I mean, even going back to like the 80s and 90s, I never paid attention to him. I figured he was just a rich trust fund baby. I never paid attention to Trump. I didn't support him during the primary. When he became the Republican nominee, I lined up again because even though I figured he's a goof, maybe he'll hire some good people. So accuse me of not sufficiently understanding who Trump was in 2016. I plead guilty for that. I am so damn disappointed in the Ted Cruz's and the Marco Rubio's of the world because that New York Times piece I wrote last week, Charlie, every Republican up on Capitol Hill agrees with it. Every single Republican, but they will not say anything.
Matt Gaetz?
Well,
Jim Jordan? I'm just gonna, what?
Well, I'll tell you what, privately, I think I don't know Matt Gaetz, but I am comfortable saying Charlie Sykes. And I don't want to exaggerate that not every Republican, but 90% of my former colleagues up on the Hill, they personally believe that this guy's a nut. He's ignorant. He doesn't pay attention. He can't tell the truth. Now, some of them have made their bargain with the devil. That's okay. I'm fine having a horrible guy in the White House as long as I can get some good policies. So some of them are still there. The rest of them just keep their mouths shut because they want to hang on to their platform, their seat in Congress.
Okay, you had a very interesting paragraph in this New York Times piece. You said, in Trump, I see the worst and ugly iteration of views I expressed for the better part of a decade. To be sure, I've had my share of controversy, and I didn't want to talk about that. On more than one occasion, I questioned Mr. Obama's truthfulness about his religion. At times, I expressed hate for my political opponents. We now see where this can lead. There's no place in our politics for personal attacks like that, and I regret making them. So let's talk about that for a minute. Because I think a lot of us, you know, when you see Donald Trump, you go, okay, this echoes things that I may have said or I may have thought, but I didn't think it was going to take that form. But you've been very, very outspoken. And you know that, you know, I mean, obviously, one of the things that you bring to the table is you can run to the right of Donald Trump on all of these issues. But you know that people are also going to say, Joe Walsh, you basically were the proto-Trump on all of these issues.
Maybe most importantly, Charlie, maybe I wrote the New York Times piece, and I say this to publicly apologize for the role that I did play in putting an unfit con man in the White House. Look, Charlie Sykes, you maybe didn't like me when I went to Congress in 2010 because I went there to raise hell. I was part of that Tea Party class. I believe this country is divided. I believe we're divided along policies and ideas. And I've been at the front lines of that fight for 9 to 10 years. Plenty of times during that fight, I went over the line. I got personal. I said stupid things. I'm very outspoken. I said Barack Obama was a Muslim on more than one occasion. A terrible, ugly thing to say that I apologize for. There are plenty of instances like that where I got personal in my rhetoric instead of focusing on the policy. Donald Trump, that's all he does. It's all ugly, personal, bigoted attacks. And I can't help but think that myself and plenty of us Tea Party folk the last 8 to 9 years, because we did get ahead of our skis on a number of issues and we did get personal, we probably helped create the environment that led to Trump.
So, for example, and let's talk about some of the things you said, and you know, and what I always to ask candidates when they're about to, you know, run, and I'm not saying that I don't know what you're going to be doing, but you know, are you ready for this? Do you know what people are going to be hitting with? So, I mean, you know, the president builds his entire campaign in part around things like birtherism, but also on the border. And you challenged Obama to secure the borders, and your term was with moats and alligators if necessary. So you went beyond the wall. You were a moats and alligators guy. So
you're right, Charlie. And I did that when I was in Congress to make a point that we're not defending our border. You're right. And I tried to have humor with it, and I talked about a moat and an alligators. But that's a perfect issue, Charlie. See, I think you do too. You understand. We understand what got Trump elected. I blame myself and some of the people in the Tea Party for the rhetoric that I used. I also, Charlie Sykes, blame the Republican establishment for giving us Trump, because the Republican establishment was asleep at the wheel, primarily on this issue of the border and people in this country illegally. Donald Trump, and he doesn't believe it. Trump doesn't believe in a damn thing except for Trump. But he tapped into this issue. Rubio, Cruz, all the rest of them, they were afraid to talk about it. This issue animated the Republican base more than any other issue. It's the issue that helped get me elected in 2010. It's the issue that animates most of my listeners on talk radio. I believe in a strong border. I think we have to defend our border. I don't think anybody should be in this country illegally. But Charlie, Donald Trump has taken that issue and he's turned it into like a dark, bigoted, xenophobic kind of a thing, where 3 weeks ago he's telling four congresswomen of color to go back to where they came from. I mean, it's bigoted with him. I don't care what color or creed you are. I want you in America as long as you come here legally.
But you're still a border hawk, right? I mean, you still want an impermeable border. So leaving aside, it's not trivial what you just said. But leaving that aside, how would a Joe Walsh border policy actually be different than a Donald Trump policy? Would it be tougher?
Well, it's actually a great question, Charlie, because think about this. So Trump got elected to build a wall and to make the border situation better. And here we are 2.5 years in and it's a mess. So he's been very incompetent in how he's dealt with it, because he doesn't think any of these things through. All Donald Trump focused on, Charlie, was the wall, the wall, the wall, the wall, the wall. I'm going to make Mexico pay for it. He never went beyond the wall. So we don't have a wall. A wall's got to be part of it. There are a lot of other assets and resources we need to use to make sure we have a secure border in addition to the wall. But this whole crisis at the border now, people coming into the country to claim asylum, that has nothing to do with a wall. And the way we're treating folks at the border now who are simply trying to claim asylum is pretty damn inhumane. And we're better than that. We've got to, you know, again, I'm a limited government guy, Charlie, but we got to pour resources down into the border to facilitate this whole asylum claim process so that people, you know, don't have to wait a year or two before their cases are adjudicated.
Okay, let's talk about some other stuff, you know, going to be thrown at you. You wrote in the Times, Trump is a racial arsonist who encourages bigotry and xenophobia to rouse his base and advance his electoral prospects. And you just talked about that. When President Obama was elected, you said that he was elected because he, quote, pushed that magical button, the black man who was articulate, liberal, the whole white guilt, all of that. And you described at one point in as recently as 2017 Stevie Wonder as another ungrateful black multimillionaire. So you're going to be hit with this, right?
Yeah, and it's interesting, Charlie. I do believe, just let's be clear about something. I do believe Trump is like a racial arsonist. When I said that, I think he uses bigotry and race just to benefit him. Like, I don't believe Donald Trump is a racist, because I don't believe he's complicated enough to be a racist. I think all Trump cares about is Trump. So if you're black and you can help him, then Trump likes you. If you're white and you don't like him and you can't help him, then Trump doesn't like you. So Trump's really simple on this. I am fascinated by the issue of race. I've got a separate podcast that I've been doing for about a year now called Uncomfortable Conversations. I do a lot of work on the South Side of Chicago with a black pastor down there. I've always been interested in problems in our inner cities. So and like you mentioned that one tweet about when Obama got elected, I think a big part of why he got elected was because he was black. And to me, that's not a negative. It was an awesome thing. You know, and I know a lot of white people, a lot of white liberals who, man, it was like, it was cool. It was empowering. It was a neat thing to be able to vote for the first black president. I believe that's part of who Barack Obama was. I don't consider that to be a negative at all. Same thing with Pete Buttigieg now. If part of what who makes Pete Buttigieg really interesting is he's gay. And if he were the Democrat nominee, there would be a lot of people who would vote for him because he's gay. Because, again, it's kind of a cool thing to be able to vote for the first gay, put the first gay man in the White House. That's not a negative to me.
Okay. Since we're on the subject of tweets, since everyone is now judged by their tweets, and you'll remember this one, July 7th, 2016, night of the shooting of the Dallas police officers.
Yes.
You wrote on Twitter, "This is now war. Watch out, Obama. Watch out, Black Lives Matter punks. Real America is coming after you."
Perfect. Charlie Sykes, that's a perfect example of Joe Walsh, who got so pissed off that I sent out a tweet I regret. So, and again, the context here, Charlie, is I've probably sent out 900 million tweets in the last 6 years. I'm sure there are a few that where I went over the line. 5 Dallas police officers were killed. I am a huge supporter of our cops. A Black Lives Matter inspired thug killed those 5 cops. I genuinely was always very disappointed in how Barack Obama did not instinctively stand with our cops and give them the benefit of the doubt. But Charlie, that's a perfect tweet where that anger of mine, 5 cops being shot and killed in Dallas, I sent out a stupid tweet that could be interpreted a million different ways, and I've apologized for that one.
Okay,
absolutely.
And it's of course something that the Donald Trump never does. The one quote that I see, the tweet that is most frequently cited in the media. You know what I'm going on this one. October 24th, 2016.
Yes.
Quote: "On November 8th, I'm voting for I'm voting for Trump. On November 9th, if Trump loses, I'm grabbing my musket. You in?"
All right, now Charlie Sykes, I'm not apologizing. This is my favorite tweet of all time.
Okay.
Because I got accused of inciting violence like if Trump didn't win. I mean, come on, a musket? Are you serious? Here's the deal. That's my infamous musket tweet. If Trump doesn't win, I'm grabbing my musket. I didn't send that tweet out because, again, I was gaga about Donald Trump. Nobody remembers, Charlie Sykes, my other musket tweet. On the morning of the election, I sent out the same tweet. I said, no matter who wins today, I'm going to grab my musket and I'm going to fight for freedom and limited government.
All right.
Because to me, and Charlie, grabbing my musket is my figurative way of saying I'm going to keep fighting for freedom and limited government.
Okay. So one more question, and you're being very patient with me, but you know, if it's not me, it's going to be somebody else on cable television, doing it. This is one where we're not in the same place, but I know that you would wince as soon as I say this. Okay, I know because I actually wince when I like asking it. So last year, 2018,
yeah,
Sacha Baron Cohen.
Oh, geez.
You see, you did right.
It's like, oh, Charlie.
Okay,
damn you.
But you know, you're going to be on the Today Show, or you're going to be on something.
Yep.
And someone's going to say,
yep.
Hey, so this is the Who Is America, and you on showing your endorsement for arming kindergartners, and you've talked about this. I mean, Sacha Baron Cohen,
he got me, baby.
He got you.
He got. Oh, and you know what, Charlie? All you can do, and this is all I tried to do, was just have fun with it.
Yeah.
Sacha Baron Cohen got me. He flew me out to D.C. to give me some big award because I was a big friend of Israel's. So he flew me out there. He put me up in a hotel. He flew me to a studio. He interviewed me for 45 minutes. He didn't. His staff did on camera about all the great things Israel's doing. And within that 45 minutes, there's 30 seconds of, and Israel even arms kindergartners to protect themselves against terrorists. Isn't it a great idea? Yes, I was absolutely fooled and conned by Sacha Baron Cohen. All I can do is laugh. And no, I don't believe 5-year-olds should be trained.
Well, the part that is the most painful, I think, was when you described and he had you like just read a teleprompter, you know, as part of this, which we've all done. But you're reading the teleprompter. The part that got me with your explanation, though, was that it was 3 a.m. the next morning, you're lying in your hotel room, and you realize, oh, my God.
What did I said, oh, my God, what did I say?
What did I do?
Charlie, and again, I don't, like, I was totally fooled. They called me up and said, you are one of Israel's greatest 70 friends. It was for the 70th anniversary of Israel, their founding, and they're going to fly me out to D.C. and do a big interview for me and give me an award. I was hooked. I got it, and I got fooled, and you're right. I woke up the next morning, and I said, no, wait a minute. That's weird. And then we looked into it, and we found out it was Sacha Baron Cohen, and all I could do is just say, I got.
Okay, so let's... you've been a good sport, but you know that this is going to be a subject of 1,000 tweets from Donald Trump. Okay, so let's talk about the challenge to Donald Trump, the upside and
yes.
the downside, and whether or not there's any room... I am struck by the fact that the more evidence of his unfitness for office comes out, and today is, I'm tempted to say that it feels worse than usual, but we've felt that
yes.
way for the last 2 years, and yet it's almost as if many of the supporters are so deeply invested that they have to double down, that the worse it is, the stronger and the more intractable they are in their support. Because we're just not seeing a significant erosion of Republican support. One of the things you said early on was that members of Congress say things in private that are very different
yeah.
than in public. So the question yeah. Is there a large group of Republicans who will go into a voting booth and do something in private that they would never do, say, on Facebook or Twitter or publicly, which is to vote against Donald Trump in a primary?
Charlie, I think if they can see an alternative, call me crazy, Charlie Sykes, but I think we're tired of this guy. I'm talking about Republicans. We're tired of the bullshit. We're tired of his daily drama. I think people are really tired of the Donald Trump show. I think Republicans are. I think they need a few people to stick their necks out and present them with an alternative. Yeah, 80, 90% of Republicans support him, but I've seen polling in New Hampshire and elsewhere where half of Republicans would like to see a primary challenge. It's going to take a few people to maybe get something to snowball, but I believe, and I don't think I'm wrong, I really do believe that everything I say about that man publicly, I do believe the vast majority of Republicans believe it privately. They just need to know, Charlie, that maybe they can get somebody strong on the borders and all of the rest, and somebody who's going to continue to push limited government policies without all the ugliness, the cruelty, the lying, and just the daily drama. I don't know, Charlie. Aren't you just tired of it?
Oh, no, I think that's a big factor. I think that there's the outrage factor, but I think there's also just the fatigue factor. So let me ask you the question that Mark Sanford was asked by, I think it was by Chuck Todd, who said, you know, he go through the whole critique
yeah.
and then asked him, well, would you vote for Donald Trump if he is the Republican nominee? And I don't want to take him out of context, but my understanding is Sanford said, yes, I'm a Republican, so I will vote for Donald Trump over a Democrat. Will you?
I watched it. That's the bad answer. That's a wrong answer. That's the terrible answer. That's not the answer you give if you're going to primary Donald Trump. He's unfit. He shouldn't be in the White House. So the answer is no. There's no way on God's green earth I could ever vote for that man again. That's pretty straightforward.
You talked with Matt Lewis from the Daily Beast last
yeah.
week at a really good podcast, and he wrote an interesting column, and he said, look, you know, making the case for a strong Republican challenge and pointing out, you know, this could cost Trump re-election. I mean, the last two incumbent presidents to lose, Jimmy Carter and
yeah.
Bush the first, were wounded by primary challenges. And then he writes, here it's worth contemplating the potential blowback, not just for the candidate, but for his cause. If Trump loses the general election, the best case scenario would be the rejection of Trumpism as a viable electoral strategy and the restoration of a Reaganite Republican Party. But if Trump and his supporters can make a stabbed in the back argument, if they can plausibly blame Trump's loss on never Trumpers, it becomes harder to persuade Republican voters the only way to win the future is to abandon Trumpism. That's all to say there could be some serious unintended consequences to encouraging a quixotic campaign. Your thoughts?
Matt Luce is a great guy, yeah. And it's an interesting theory. Here's my, I guess my quick answer is Donald Trump ain't going anywhere anyways when he loses in November, and he'll blame everybody for his loss no matter what. But none of that matters to me. What matters to me is we have somebody in the White House right now who is tweeting this country into a recession. We have somebody in the White House right now, Charlie. My God, if he's given another 4 years, the way he's man-hugging Kim and Putin, who knows what kind of danger America will be in. It is imperative that somebody challenge him, no matter what the consequences might be beyond November. And Charlie, you believe in and love the Republican Party like I do.
Love is a strong word.
Yeah, we've always been comfortable with the Republican Party. Way to walk. Look at me walk that one back.
Yeah, comfortable is our strong word.
We can deal with the Republican Party. But if the Republican Party doesn't take a stand now against this man as their standard bearer, and they allow him to be their standard bearer, and they allow him to get beat in November, I think they're going to be impotent. If guys like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, all these people kind of hiding out right now, all of them, and they just want Trump to go away, and none of them have the balls to stand up and say he's wrong, I don't care what it does to my career, we have to make a stand against him now. I will not have the time of day for those people after 2020.
Okay, I want to ask you another question about this. But first, I want to hear from our sponsor today. Look, if you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. But the problem that growing businesses have that keeps them from knowing their numbers is their hodgepodge of business systems. They have one system for accounting, another one for sales, another one for inventory. It's just a big, inefficient mess, taking up too much time, too many resources, and of course, that hurts the bottom line. So we're introducing NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles aspects of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform, giving you the visibility and control you need to grow. With NetSuite, you save time, money, and unneeded headaches by merging together sales, financing, accounting, orders, and HP instantly, you know, right from your desktop or your phone. That's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system. And right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights with a free guide, key strategies to grow your profits. And you can find that at netsuite.com/bulwark. That is netsuite.com/bulwark to download your free guide, these key strategies to grow your profits. netsuite.com/bulwark. Okay, we're back with former Congressman Joe Walsh, who has been making a very, very strong, very high profile pitch for the need for a Republican challenger. So is it going to be you, Joe?
Not trying to be cute or coy or clever, because I can't be. I haven't ruled it out. I know two things at this point. The only reason you primary Donald Trump is the moral case. He's unfit. You have to get him out of the White House.
Okay.
And if somebody's going to challenge him, Charlie, you better get out there pretty quickly.
So why would, hypothetically, Joe Walsh be better than Mark Sanford, John Kasich, Jeff Flake?
All good men, but Mark Sanford and maybe Kasich or Flake could make this case as well as I could. It's the moral case. I've seen Mark out there now for a few weeks, and he's talking about the debt and the deficits. I'm sorry, the debt and the deficits is an issue, but you don't primary Trump because you want to start a conversation about the debt. That just doesn't make sense. I wrote the New York Times piece, Charlie, because I would love somebody bigger and better than Joe Walsh to step up and do this.
So what do you think is going to happen? Let's assume that there is a strong, vigorous primary challenge, which still seems very, very quixotic at this point. What do you think happens in a place like New Hampshire?
I think little brush fires could begin. And I think in New Hampshire and Iowa, again, if voters can hear from a strong, committed conservative who's not going to give them all the bull, the BS, the lying, and the cruelty and all the drama every day. I think small little wildfires could develop all over New Hampshire and Iowa and the rest of the country. I think there are a lot of Republicans out there just dying for an alternative. People are afraid to stick their necks out.
Is there a magic number? Is there a magic number that people would go, oh my goodness, Trump is actually vulnerable. The ground is shifting under his feet. Is it 30%, 35%, 38%?
That's above my pay grade. I honestly don't know. You might have a better sense of something like that. I think there's an opportunity out there to really tap into something, to tap into a little bit of magic.
Well, I think that's the question, and I keep thinking of 1968 when Eugene McCarthy challenged Lyndon Johnson. That, of course, is the model. And Lyndon Johnson won in New Hampshire. People seem to forget that, but it was he underperformed so dramatically that it was kind of the uh-oh moment. And the Eugene McCarthy campaign, my father was the campaign manager for Eugene McCarthy in 1968 here in Wisconsin. And we sort of started small, and I can remember this. This was a formative experience of my life and how quickly that happened. Of course, politics has changed. Do you think that Donald Trump can be reelected next year? In a general election?
No. And it's not, I mean, we've got 2018. 2018 was a referendum on Trump, and Trump got spanked, and Republicans got spanked. It was the biggest differential between Democrats and Republicans vote in a midterm ever. So that was a referendum on Trump. 2020 is going to be a referendum on Trump. Charlie, you know, like I know, he's lost the suburbs. All he's doing is he's talking to the 35% of the American people who would support him if he shot somebody in Manhattan. And all he's doing is trying to get them revved up, and he's turning off and pissing off the other 65% of this country. You can't win that way. There's no way he can win in 2020.
You know what intrigues me about what you're doing is, you know, folks like me, folks like Bill Kristol, I would suppose Bill, you know, Bill Weld as well. We're accused of, well, you've become liberals. Well, you hang out with Democrats, which is not true. But there's really no way they can say that about you. I mean, you are still, you know, even though you've apologized for the language and the rhetoric you used, you are still pretty hardcore conservative on all of those basic issues. You're a full spectrum conservative, aren't you?
Yes, who has my road to Damascus moment, Charlie Sykes. I haven't changed a dime on any issue since I got elected in 2010, excuse me. I've changed my tone. And it was the election of Donald Trump that forced me to change my tone. You've got Trump and people out there saying that AOC hates America, or Ilhan Omar hates America. 6, 7, 8 years ago, Joe Walsh would have said something like that. I don't believe that. I don't want to attack them personally. Ilhan Omar believes in a different America than I do. Donald Trump has forced me to clean up my act and to focus on policy differences.
We've talked about this before, that your sort of your road to Damascus moment was the press conference in Helsinki. That was the breaking point.
Oh.
But which I understand, and we've talked about, but it's interesting because, you know, I was on talk radio for 23 years as well. And that moment when you look back and you go, wow, you know what? I mean, I said things like that, and then you hear it echo, sort of bizarre world re-echoed. It's a disorienting experience, isn't it?
Hugely. Charlie Sykes, absolutely. And as somebody like you, who has been in talk radio for so many years, look, when Trump got elected, again, I didn't like him. I didn't love him. So I did the whole good Trump, bad Trump thing. I'd give him a pat on the back when he did something good on the radio. I'd
balls and
criticize. I'd criticize him when he didn't. But that only lasted a few months. I right away realized I can't believe anything that comes out of his mouth. And then finally at Helsinki, that was it. So for the past year and a half or so, I've been on the radio pretty much a never Trumper. And you know my audience. It's not an audience that wants to hear that. But I'll tell you something, Charlie. This is what's intriguing. I have noticed month by month, more and more people in mega hat wearing conservative talk radio listeners who are more open to criticism of him, the man. And a lot of my listeners are at, Joe, I agree with you that he's a bad dude, But come on, Joe, the Democrats are socialists. So a lot of my listeners now are hanging between, are hanging right there, which is not where they were a couple of years ago.
You know, I did a we did a podcast the other day on talk radio, and one of the points that I made was that there are virtually few, there are virtually no anti-Trump conservative talk show hosts in the country. You are one of them. But we're at the moment now where I almost feel, well, I don't almost feel, I don't know why I keep saying things like that, but there's no business model for being a conservative broadcaster who is anti-Trump. But you've hung in there. Can you think of any others? Are there any others other than what you're doing now?
No, I can't. I mean, I'm syndicated around the country. I can't. And Charlie, I don't want to pat myself on the back because let's be real. I don't know how long I can hang in here.
get that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my days could be numbered because of who I am on the radio. As we get closer to the election, you know, these companies, they want you to line up. What team, what tribe are you part of? So I don't know that I can make it work.
Yeah, this is one of the things. I mean, I left for other reasons than Trump, but it made it easier.
Right.
And I try to imagine what it would be like to be on the air right now, being honest about Donald Trump in an era in which many, I think, consumers of conservative media want conservative media to be a safe space for them. They don't want
They want Hannity, baby. Give me Hannity where I wash Trump's feet every day, or give me any one of these guys, right, where they think Trump, they will say Trump walks on water every day. But I do, and again, I don't think I could make it because I think this election cycle, I think I'm going to be told you got to line up or not. But I have noticed a change, Charlie, in listeners, more and more listeners willing to accept some criticism. But the Democrats are bad. So what do we do, Joe? I get a lot of that.
So what is the weak spot? I mean, when you say they're willing to accept, which criticisms are they willing to accept?
Personally, that the guy is dishonest and I would never want to do business with him. I'd never want to live with him. I'd never want him to be my father. I mean, I think a lot of talk radio listeners, Trump supporters, part of that 35%, they don't like the man at all. Now, again, if you can have a conservative out there pounding Trump in a Republican primary, a lot of moderate Republicans who would think the conservative's too conservative just hate Trump. So, but you could actually eat into Trump's conservative base because there's growing awareness that he's a bad guy. And I think they're really tired of his day-to-day drama.
Joe Walsh, we used to call you Woke Joe Walsh, but it's time, I think, to move on from that. Woke Joe Walsh, I think this is your third appearance on the Bulwark podcast, and I appreciate
Love the Bulwark.
And appreciate you giving us so much of your time today.
Charlie, it's always an honor. Thank you, sir.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark podcast. Today's episode was brought to you by NetSuite. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.